let's make sure you are in fellowship here and continue on. We are working on verses 14 and 15. I am under obligation, Paul says, both to the Greeks and the barbarians, both to the wise and to the foolish, so that for my part, I am eager to preach the gospel to you also who are in Rome. And we left off here at the end of first session with about point 16 here. The Greek adjective sophos, wise, referred to a clever person that knew how to do things, how to build things, or had been instructed in the philosophical disciplines of the great teachers. 17, the second adjective, anoetos, literally means to be without understanding. It is clearly the opposite of wise and means to be senseless, foolish, or stupid. 18, thus the wise focused on those that had a formal education and had been instructed in the disciplines of life. The foolish refers to those that lacked formal education and training. And 19, this clearly demonstrates that such factors as IQ, education, and training are also not factors in hearing, learning, and orienting to the plan of God. It has been taught in some quarters that if you have a higher IQ, you can learn more doctrine. That's just flat out fallacious. It's wrong. Paul said, in fact, that when dealing with this matter of relative human intelligence and things like this, he said, when I came to Corinth, which was viewed as being one of the premier cities of that day, in an intellectual sense, Tarsus, where Paul had came from, Corinth, Athens, these were viewed as being the intellectual centers of their day. And he said, when I came in there, I did not try to appeal to your learning or any of this. I made the gospel as simple as possible for you to understand that your faith does not rest on the wisdom of men and how well and how sophisticated a way I can present the truth. It rests on the very simple foundation of the truth itself, that Christ died for your sins. And as he said, when I came in there, I didn't get off on all these tangents. And just like in our day today, there are all these philosophical and scientific and other sort of tangents. If you get a chance, there's a little deal. Now, it won't appeal to everybody because this guy can be a little off color. But if you know who the Ali G is, Sasha Cohen, I just saw recently there was a deal where he interviewed the scientists and he was asking him about evolution. And this was designed to be funny and point out the stupidity of this stuff. And he said, so we're descended from apes, huh? And he said, yeah. He said, well, okay, so we should probably take, you know, you guys have probably taken an ape and shaved it to make it look human to see that we're exactly the same. And he goes, no, we haven't done that. And he said, well, if this is all working, he said, like, when will those apes become human? Like the apes today, they're going to become human at some point. He says, no, we don't believe that. Essentially saying, espousing evolution on the one hand and saying he didn't believe it on the other. Because there's no evidence of any evolutionary process today at all. And so they say, no, that's not going to happen. It just happened millions of years ago. So he's saying, like, you're saying my grandma slept with an ape? I mean, it's designed to be humorous, but it's also designed to point out the folly of what passes as knowledge in our culture. And it's available, if you search for it, you can just do Ali G interview on evolution, and you'll probably find it on YouTube. But let me warn you, some of it's, you know, risque, so I don't want any of you to go spinning out and freaking out. So anytime I recommend anything, it's, you know, it's as is. I'm not providing any warranty or, you know, guarantees. So I thought that was just hilarious, though. We believed in evolution, but we don't believe it's actually happening now. Well, then that seems to be a problematic. Well, see, again, this idea that, again, intellectual training and all of this, it can be helpful. We're not against intellectual training. It's not bad to have a good vocabulary. It's not bad to know certain things. But again, certain things will not help you learn the plan of God, no matter how good you are at. So 20, it should be observed that in these terms, Paul is not speaking of prejudicial, arrogant, derogatory, or contemptuous fashion. He is merely viewing things as they are normally perceived in an objective and factual manner. That there are people that are considered to be Greeks and barbarians, wise and foolish. These are just normal ways we would categorize the human race. 21, Cranfield points out that the first two groupings were viewed to be viewed as entire communities, while the second two adjectives referred to individuals. Now, that is true. The Greeks and barbarians would be considered to be like whole cultures. Wise and unwise would really focus down on the individual person more than, say, a group of them. So, 22, Paul references his attitude and position toward the Gentiles as being one of indebtedness. The Greek noun ophaletes first referred to one that had a financial obligation or debt toward another. If you borrow some money from somebody, you have an obligation. You know, you have this financial debt that you have to pay, whether it's credit card company or, you know, for whatever it may be. Well, 23, he uses it here to refer to the obligation that his apostolic commission placed on him. As the apostle that God appointed to the Gentiles, Paul was obligated to communicate God's plan to those Gentiles without exception. 1 Corinthians 9:16. And it's very clear that Paul takes all of this very seriously. And he says here, "For if I preach the gospel, I don't have anything to brag about, because I am under compulsion. For woe is me if I do not preach the gospel." And so Paul recognized that he had this obligation that was placed on him if he was going to fulfill this. There's a different word here. It's not the same word for obligation. The word he uses here is epikaimai. It really has the idea of something is laid upon you. That's what kaimai means, to be placed or laid upon. So God laid upon Paul this obligation that if you're going to be the apostle to the Gentiles, you've got to communicate to all the Gentiles. You can't pick and choose. But then again, this is true of all communicators. You can't pick and choose. You just have to teach who's there. Teach the ones that show up. 23, he uses it here to refer again to the obligation. 24, although Paul speaks of his ministry in terms of an obligation to be fulfilled, it is evident from what follows that he did not regard the repayment of his debt as a burden. He begins verse 15 with the adverb huto, which refers to what precedes, and links his obligation with the explanation of the manner in which he fulfills it. I am under obligation. And he says, so as far as I see it, the way I look at all of this is, I'm eager to fulfill this. 26, the entire phrase, to kate me prothumon, has been understood in various ways, but the sense of thus my eagerness, or thus or I for my part am eager, pretty much conveys sort of the sense of the whole phrase. In this case, and again, I see this pretty regularly on the Greek message boards and stuff. You know, people, you can always tell they're brand new, too, when they say, I would like a literal verse-by-verse, word-by-word rendition of the Greek into English. Well, you can't all the time. Some translations are idiomatic. Some translations are prepositional phrases that you have to sort of treat in just as a whole rather than breaking it down into each specific word. You can look at each word, but it doesn't always necessarily give you the best translation. So 27, Paul explains that his sense of obligation, which stemmed from the fact that God had appointed him as an apostle to the Gentiles, resulted in an eager desire on his part to pay that obligation. 28, for Paul, repaying the obligation was not so much a matter of duty as it was a great privilege to proclaim the unfathomable riches of Christ. Ephesians 3:1-10, and this is how Paul views it, was that God had blessed him with tremendous insight and understanding into his plan, and that that blessing resulted in him being very excited about teaching the realities of what he had learned. And that pretty much is the way it should be, frankly, for all believers, but specifically for communicators. And when he talks about in verse 2 of the stewardship of God's grace that was given to me for you, Paul always interpreted the blessings that God provided in terms of revelation and knowledge as blessings that were not merely for him alone, although that is one of the great benefits of the study of the Word of God and revelation, is that one gets it for himself. That's part of it. But Paul always viewed this as it was given to me for you. That the real objects of all of this are those to whom he communicates. That they are the ones who also receive these great insights if he communicates all these mystery doctrines effectively. And he deals with all of that. And in verse 8, he kind of sums it up. To me, the very least of all saints, this grace was given to preach to the Gentiles the unfathomable riches of Christ and to bring to light what is the administration of the mystery, which has for ages been hidden in God who created all things. So 29, Paul has made it plain that he is under obligation to every Gentile in the world. He is ready, willing, and anxious to come to Rome and fulfill his obligation toward them through the proclamation of the gospel. So 30, in this, Paul manifests what every communicator of the truth should possess. Every communicator should not regard his commission as some joyless duty to be fulfilled, but should readily and willingly be prepared to voluntarily fulfill the ministry to which he has been assigned. Peter deals with that in his epistle. 1 Peter 5 talks about this as the two ways one can approach the ministry, the teaching of the truth. And there are many things that can discourage a communicator, but the fact is, you're not to let these things get you down. In 5:2, he says, "Shepherd the flock of God among you voluntarily, not doing it under compulsion because you have an obligation for any other motivation, but that you do this voluntarily according to God, that God is your standard." And so the idea here is that, again, if people are in the ministry and they find it to be a grind, they don't like it, they wish they were doing something else, I say to them, go do something else. Get out. Believers don't need that kind of a leader. They need someone who is doing it from the soul and does it with all their gusto and puts all they have into it. Again, as we've seen, saw there in Mark, you're only going to get out of stuff what you put into it. Be careful how you hear, and be careful what you listen to. And be careful what you bring to the table, because what you bring to the table is what you're going to get back. And those people that bring minimal orientation, minimal desire, minimal inclination to hear the truth, guess what? They get minimal back. That's just the way God operates. The law of sowing and reaping governs many, many things. Well, 31, while many have taken the final thought of proclaiming good news to you all at Rome to refer to the simple matter of evangelism, that misses the point to some extent. First, it is clear that Paul is writing to believers. So this idea of like simple evangelism, I'm coming there to give you the gospel. Duh, he's already called them brothers multiple times in this. He's already acknowledged that they're calling, in that sense, in verse 7, called saints, is on the same par divinely as his called apostle in verse 1. He uses the very same structure and setup. And so it's very clear that Paul knows that he's writing to believers. And this is one of the problems. I am just stunned still till this very day of how many commentators will look at the Bible and say, well, I saw this the other day in a commentary I was looking at on something else. It wasn't Romans. I think it was 1 John. And he said, oh, Paul or John's writing to unbelievers. No, he's not. Why would he do that? What's to be gained by that? You evangelize unbelievers. You don't write letters to them telling them how to live the Christian life. That's nonsense. And I'm just stunned that, you know, when certain things don't fit. And this guy was arguing against the necessity of rebound, strangely enough. That you don't need to rebound if you're a believer. And my weird take on it was you only need to rebound if you're a believer. he was suggesting once you're saved, you don't need to confess a sin at all ever. You're always saved. Well, that's true. You are always saved. But that also ignores, well, what happens when you sin? Does God not do anything ever? Where does discipline come from if he doesn't do anything? But the point is, of course, when you sin, you break fellowship with God. Or better yet, he breaks fellowship with you because he is the righteous one and must maintain his separate holy status at all times. So, as far as I know, the only way to get back into fellowship is, and then, I mean, I don't know how he got around all this, but he basically just ignored clearly, if we say we have not sinned, we make him a liar. He's saying, well, yeah, you got sin and sin and sin, but you just don't ever have to deal with it. Well, that's a convenient way to live the Christian life. You're just perfect and it doesn't matter what you do. Now that is a license to do what you want. Rebound is not. Well, again, to suggest that Paul's writing here to to people who haven't been evangelized is nonsense. He knows they're believers. Well, first, Paul is, it's clear he's writing to believers who he believes to be oriented to the truth at a substantial level. He's already addressed them as brothers as well in verse 8. Your faith is proclaimed throughout the whole world. And then brothers, and he's addressed them as called saints. So in what way does he deem them not to be oriented? I don't see anything so far that suggests to me at all that Paul deemed the Romans not to be oriented. So 33, thus it should be evident that Paul's conception of the gospel was that there was more to it than simply information that related to phase one salvation. 34, it is clear for Paul that the gospel dealt not only with the initial matter of salvation, but subsequent matters of spiritual growth. All the issues, in fact, relating to the Christian way of life, and it dealt with eternal rewards. Clearly here, when he says, I long to preach the gospel to you, in verse 11, he had said a similar thing when he said, I long to see you so that I may impart some spiritual benefit. Well, he had this concept of imparting a spiritual benefit to people that were already believers as a part of the gospel. That this is what, this is an outflow of that. Also, Galatians 1:23. So this is an outflow. The gospel doesn't stop with phase one. Many, and again, we, for the purposes of analysis, we do divide it up, but it should be clear that we understand that the gospel encompasses the whole of God's plan. It's not just believe in Jesus Christ and you will be saved. That's part of it. It is. But then there's all the, you're going to suffer many trials and tribulations and you've got to endure through them all. That's part of the gospel. The SG3, as we're going to see, is a part of the gospel. The eternal rewards concept is a part of the gospel. The wrath of God being revealed from heaven, that's a part of the gospel. The fact that Jesus is going to judge every man at the end of it all, that's a part of it. The judgment is part of the gospel. So the gospel encompasses a bunch of things. Galatians 1:23, but only they kept hearing. He who persecuted us is now preaching the faith, which he once tried to destroy. So again, his gospel presentation is viewed in terms, in this context at least, in terms of the faith, the body of Christian knowledge and understanding. Not just believe and be saved. That's, again, that is the gospel in its simplest terms. Ephesians 3:8-10. Actually, I think we just read that one. And as a part of the gospel here, he says, he calls it the unfathomable riches of Christ. And to bring to light the administration of the mystery, which for ages has been hidden in God who created all things, so that the manifold wisdom of God might be made now known through the church, to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. And this is one of the issues in a local church. You are withstanding demonic onslaught. You are a witness against the demonic and satanic viewpoints. And so guess what? You're a target. You are a big target in all of this. They want to neutralize you. They want to control your thinking. They want to get into your head. They want you to become convinced that you don't have to live up to certain standards. This is where we get into the issue, say, of the witness of the life. Yeah, you're a big target in all this because guess what? The little local church here is making a strong statement in the last days in the angelic conflict that those who aren't doing it right, well, they're going to be on the hook for, because now you got this example. You got this example of these poor, pitiful wretches. I'll call you guys the wretches. Led by the great Ron. I'll be the great Ron. I'm kidding, of course. But that all of us in our insignificance, and the fact that we're just one person out here in a world of 7 billion people, But that this all makes a huge difference. And this makes a mark. This makes a stand in the angelic conflict. And right, and you talk about being blessed, right at the last critical hour, here you have the opportunity to make a stand for the truth. And then the hour is fading fast, as we know. I don't think I sent it out to y'all, but I should have. But I think I did mention it, that this idea that Russia is really scared, but they've acknowledged, hey, we're the only people that can reduce you to nuclear ash. We're the only nation in the world that can do this. And nobody's arguing with them that I've ever seen. And they intend to. And so here you are right on the cusp of all of this, living in a nation that's headed for destruction, just as many of the ancient prophets did in Israel. They were living, there were prophets living various times right up until, say, Jeremiah was living right up until the Babylonian captivity. Daniel was a part of that. And he even went, was a part of the refugees. He went to Babylon as a captive. So here the idea is we have this opportunity to bring all these things to light, and that God is using the local church to manifest his superior wisdom to the rulers and authorities in the heavenly places. These refer again to demonic hierarchy of demons that exist out there. Everything from the cosmocrator demons, the world forces of darkness, down to the demon that works your block. Probably have a demon that works your block. Who knows? Wouldn't shock me. We don't know, number one, we do not know the numbers of the demons. We do know that they are highly organized, though. We also know that their viewpoint is constantly attacking the truth. Philippians here, 1:16 and 1:27. Paul says he's appointed for the defense of the gospel. That's also part of his niche, not just the proclaiming of it, but defending the truths and the realities that are in it. And verse 27, only conduct yourselves in a manner worthy of the gospel. This is where the gospel touches the phase two issues of life and the witness of the life. So that whether I come and see you or remain absent, I will hear of you, that you are standing firm in one spirit, with one mind striving together for the faith of the gospel. And the next one, Colossians 1:5. He says, because of the hope. Now hope, when you see this phrase hope, term hope, or the term inheritance, or inherit, he's always talking about the future rewards package. The hope is from what we don't see yet. Hope that is seen, as he says in Romans, is not hope. So what are we hoping for? The hope of being laid up for you in heaven. This refers to the eternal rewards as the believer makes the sacrifices necessary in his time in history to do those things which are commensurate with the gospel, of which he says you previously heard in the word of truth, the gospel. So for a part of Paul's gospel teaching wasn't just that the wrath of God is being revealed from heaven, and it is, and that there is a coming judgment in which all men will be judged according to their deeds. There is. But it was that you can escape all this through Jesus Christ. Not only can you escape all this, you can have tremendous inheritance and reward eternally up the road. That's the whole scope of the gospel, covers everything, essentially from the beginning to end. Well, 35, that's the idea of proclaiming the gospel to those at Rome, contains the reality of initial evangelization of those that have not heard the good news and the ongoing work of teaching the disciples. And that, of course, involves phase two and phase three issues that you have to instruct people in regard to. 36, the nonsense that Paul is desirous of coming to Rome to establish Rome as a client nation. The entire concept of the client nation is unscriptural nonsense. Because he wanted to replace Israel is so biblically indefensible as to invite ridicule. First, it's very plain that Israel is the only nation ever that was selected by God to have a unique relationship with him. This concept of priest nations and client nations is the invention of men. This does not exist in the scriptures. You can't prove, the only way you could is a loose interpretation of the words, I will make you a kingdom of priests. Well, but that doesn't mean every Israelite was a priest. Only the tribe of Levi were priests. You had to be a son of Aaron to be a priest. So not all Israelites were priests. But he makes this one agreement, one contract, one covenant with one nation, Israel. And then when he sets them aside, he replaces them with the church. That's it. Period. Over and out. The nonsense that somehow Rome became the next client nation, and then Britain became the next client nation, and now the U.S. is a client nation. This is just nonsense that you can't support biblically. It is not taught in the scriptures anywhere. This is what I like to call, this is beyond creative exegesis. This is a psychological nonsense and spiritual nonsense. I can see where some verses you might say, well, I could make an argument for this. You can't even make an argument for this from the scriptures. Jesus said, I will take this away from you and give it to another nation producing the fruit of it. And every Orthodox interpreter I've ever seen says that that's the church. That it's the church that replaced Israel. And that's the nature of dispensationalism at that level. Well, 37, the church is the nation that was to replace Israel and has already done so by this time spiritually, by our time anyway, not by 57. They hadn't. The church already was in the process of replacing Israel, but Israel still existed in 57 AD. They didn't fully get decimated until 60 or 70 AD. Matthew 21:43, and this is the germane prophecy here. And it was told, if you remember this, we studied this, there's a parallel in Mark in chapter 12. And this was the parable of the landowner who planted a vineyard. And put a wall around it and dug a wine press in it and built a tower. And these recalcitrant tenants, these idiots, came in. He rented it out to them. They decided they were going to abuse him, weren't going to pay him his proceeds, didn't pay the rent. And so then when the guy sent to collect, they'd kill his messengers. And they'd kill one group of messengers, pardon me, and then they'd kill another group of messengers. Then finally he says, well, I'll send them my son. They'll at least respect that. No, they didn't. They took his son and threw him out of the vineyard and killed him. And when the owner of the vineyard, verse 40, comes, what will he do to these vine growers? They said to him, he will bring those wretches to a wretched end and will rent out the vineyard to other vine growers, who will pay him the proceeds at the proper season. And Jesus said, did you never read the scriptures? The stone which the builders rejected, the religious establishment of Israel are the builders. The stone is Jesus himself. This became the chief cornerstone, and it's marvelous in our eyes. Therefore, I say to you, the kingdom of God will be taken away from you and given to a people producing the fruit of it. And I haven't seen an Orthodox interpretation of this verse that doesn't say that that's the church. That the church is the organization that replaced Israel. And that will remain so until Israel begins their spiritual recovery, which may be in some ways underway even at this moment. That there may be the surfacing, the acknowledgement of positive volition, we don't know. We know that essentially at the beginning of, or the end of the age of Israel, in that dispensation you had the age of Israel, the positive volition of the Jews were going down, and the positive volition among the Gentiles was going up. Then you move into the church age. Things continued along this line. Then at the end of the church age, it's going to be just the opposite. The Jews are going to begin, at some sense, a positive recovery. And the Gentiles, as we see, when you look at the church and you see the prophecies as compared, say, in the book of Revelation and other places, the church is a mess. It is a Laodicean, lukewarm piece of crap, frankly. That makes Jesus so sick at his stomach that he wants to puke most believers out of his mouth. Now that's sad, but that's the nature of where we are spiritually. And failure to proclaim that, to me, does not do people any good. That you better be hot. That's one of the things he tells the Laodiceans. You're lukewarm. You're neither hot nor cold. He said, I want you to be hot. Be hot, therefore, and change your mind. Of course, when he said in the beginning stages, I wish you were hot or cold, he doesn't really wish they were cold. It's an idiom for, he's trying to get a point across there. And so here you have, at the last days, these small Philadelphia-type churches fulfilling the mandate to hold fast to the word. And then you have the vast majority of Christendom out here, which is just a mess. for various reasons, but the biggest reason, we can all trace it all back to a rejection of the Word of God at some level. Failure to teach it. Failure to enforce it. Failure to exhort believers to abide by it. Okay, well now Paul tells them, I'm ready to come. And he's been talking, of course the gospel is the focal point of all of this, as you might imagine. Starting in verse 1, set apart for the gospel of God. And then he defines that gospel as being promised beforehand. And the subject of the gospel is concerning his son. And he said, I serve God, in verse 9, proclaiming the gospel of his son. And he says, now I want to come to Rome. And I'm eager to preach the gospel in Rome. Verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel. He continues his thoughts here. For I am not ashamed of the gospel. For it is the power of God for salvation. To everyone who believes, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. For here, as you've got the explanatory conjunction gar, introduces the reasoning for Paul's eagerness. For I am not ashamed is the negative ou, plus the verb present deponent indicative of ep iskunomai. Epaischunomai. 11 times this word is used. To be ashamed. And it takes the accusative of the person or thing of which one is ashamed. And so here you have the accusative, but with the negative, ooh, I am not ashamed of the good news. To euangelion, the gospel. For, another explanatory conjunction here, now focusing off the gospel. His first explanatory conjunction keyed off of his eagerness to preach the gospel. That eagerness is based on the fact that he's not ashamed of the gospel. You're not eager to do that which brings you a physical, mental, spiritual, emotional trauma. People aren't interested in that. He's eager because the gospel is not something that causes him trauma. It doesn't bother him. He's not mentally, physically, emotionally, or spiritually challenged by it in that sense. So he keys off of that with the first gar. Then he talks about the gospel, for explanatory here about the gospel, the power of God. Nominative feminine singular of dunamis, the word for power, coupled with the genitive of theos, God, T-H-E-O-S. It is the power of God, a genitive of possession here, power that God possesses. It is. Present indicative of I mean, it keeps on being. The gospel always is the power of God. This is almost a nomic use of the present indicative, which refers to sort of ongoing truths or principles that are always correct. The gospel always, the good news, always is the power of God. Into salvation or leading to salvation, you got the directional preposition eis, which denotes motion into something, and then soteria, the word for salvation, S-O-T-E-R-I-A. The power of God for salvation. Again, you got eis with the accusative. The idea of is leading to salvation, leading to the experience of salvation. Not just as some might say, well, they led up to it, but they didn't quite get there. No, it leads into it. And that's the difference between, say, eis and pros. Leading to salvation for everyone. Dative of advantage here, pos. All, each, or every, depending on context. But here we have a singular, so we're going to have to go with everyone. Everyone who believes is a regular way of expressing this. You got the definite article with the participle of pistuo. P-I-S-T-E-U-O, the verb to believe. It is the gospel, it is the power of God leading to salvation for everyone who believes. Both, then you've got this conjunction here, ta kai. So you can translate this here, not only to the Jew or both to the Jew first, and also to the Greek. And then you got eudaios, Jew, which just means a descendant of Abraham, a Jew, first. Adverb protos, this is the sort of MO Jesus used at the first advent when he told the disciples, don't go to anybody but the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And then when these various Gentiles would approach him from time to time, Jesus was very off-putting. It didn't mean that he never helped them. He did. But we saw that Syrophoenician woman. She was not a racial Jew. And she comes to him and says, "I need some help." He said, "Get away from me. I'm sent to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." Then she says, "Okay, fine." No, she didn't. She said, "No, no, look. You may have been sent to them. I get that. But, you know, even the little dogs get to eat the crumbs that fall off the table." And Jesus said, "Your faith is great. You figured this out." So he basically calls her a dog. He insults her. I'm not sent to dogs. And she said, "Well, I may be a little dog. And I don't take offense at your words, but I want the blessing. So you fix my daughter. She's demon-possessed and I need help. And you're the only one that can do it." And so he cures her. Jesus heals her because of this woman's faith. And several times when Jesus speaks of faith in the Bible, it was almost never towards the Jews. It was the Roman centurion was commended for his faith. That woman was told, "Your faith is great." She was not Jewish. And when he talked about that Roman centurion, he said, "I haven't found faith as great in anybody in Israel as I found in this guy." And that's a sad commentary on where Israel was in their thinking at that point. Couldn't exercise faith. And that was another whole thing in that Ali G interview that reminded me of too. at the very beginning of it, he said, he goes, "Well, why is it, you know," of course you got to hear this guy, he's got this weird accent that you'd have to appreciate. But he's asking him, "Well, why is it, you know, like thus and such?" And he doesn't use good English at all when he's talking to him. But he says, "Why is it?" He said, "Well, we believe." He goes, "You believe." He said, so he didn't come out and say it, but he essentially implies, so all you're saying is based on faith. Your whole scientific theory is based on faith. And he points this out right at the beginning of this interview, and I just thought that was hilarious. And again, they believe in evolution, but not today. It's suddenly a stop somehow. But at any rate, he did point out to him, guess what? All your scientific theory, everything is based on faith. You believe. And at one point in the interview, I can't remember where it was, and he goes, "So you say." And he goes, "Yes, so we say." And they had to acknowledge that, well, yeah, we're just saying this based on what we believe. So, it is this power of God for salvation to everyone who believes. Well, guess what? Everybody in the world exercises faith in something. All the time you do it. But everybody exercises faith. This idea that science is empirical and we can prove everything it says is just hogwash and nonsense. Nobody can recreate the beginning of the universe. Nobody can recreate the formation of man. Nobody can recreate the global flood. There are so many things we can't empirically do in a laboratory. And yet science has our answers. Well, it doesn't. The gospel has our answers. Do the Jew first. So Jesus did this, and this is what he manifested. And Paul continues to use this dictum. To the Jew first, and also to the Greek. Okay, point one here, let's get into this. We won't finish this today, I know. But these next two verses form the conclusion of Paul's introduction and provide the transition into the main body of the letter. While verse 16 is introduced with the explanatory conjunction, which continues to expand on the thought of the previous verse, verses 16 and 17 set forth the entire theme for the book of Romans. And that is the gospel, as it relates to the power of God resulting in salvation. For in it, a righteousness, better translation here, a righteousness from God is revealed. And so the question, of course, obviously one has to deal when one deals with God, is this matter of his righteousness. And how do you relate to God's righteousness? In terms of overall function and content. And the reality is nobody measures up to God's righteousness because it's perfect. He is right about everything at all times. Anybody here want to make that statement? You're right about everything at all times. None of us are. The arrogance to even suggest that you could be. And so we all fall short of that righteousness. But God says, look, this isn't the righteousness I'm looking for anyway. Your relative human righteousness does not get the job done. So the gospel reveals a righteousness from God. And it's revealed from faith to faith. And as it is written, and this dictum governs the entirety in some ways of Christianity, the righteous shall live by faith. You're either living by faith or you're walking by sight. Those are your two choices. And we need to live by faith. Well, the entire theme of the book is set forth here in these two verses. The structure of the two verses are comprised of four subordinate clauses, each of which is designed to build upon and elaborate upon the one that precedes it. For the mention of proclaiming the gospel in Rome naturally leads one to consider the fact that Rome was the capital and was viewed as the premier city in all the empire. Well, that's sort of the way it is in life today. Certain places are viewed as the center of the universe. They're not really. For all the New Yorkers, I'm sorry, it's not the center of the universe. For all you in L.A., it's not the center of the universe, or Paris, or Amsterdam, or wherever you think it is. I think Putin thinks it's Moscow. Well, it's not. None of these are the center of the universe. But you recognize that certain places are important in terms of their reach and their impact and their influence on places. Well, five, at this time, Rome was viewed by many as the center of the world, was a very cosmopolitan city, and exercised a unique influence over the entire empire. Six, the culture very much reflected the matter of Greek wisdom, which exalted the standards of pagan philosophers and poets. Like the Greeks, the Romans took pride in their philosophical sophistication and their rationalism. And rationalism, again, is not something new or unique to our last days, as many think. The rationalism and all of this is something of new origin. It's not. Many of the great Greek philosophers and all were rationalists. They looked at things from a strictly human perspective. They tried to factor in God to some extent in some occasions, but they had difficulty doing so because they had no real knowledge of God. They would refer to him, but they couldn't explain him. And they certainly couldn't put into play what it was exactly he wanted. They would acknowledge from time to time his existence, but that was about as far as it went. Rome generally practiced very polytheistic forms of religion that contained elements of immorality intertwined with their religious practices. Further, they had great difficulty in accepting the idea of a single, omniscient, omnipotent God. I saw an old movie the other day. I think it was from like 60 or something. They take a few liberties. It's a movie, for God's sake. And don't watch a movie to get your gospel or your doctrine. But if you can watch a movie without that, it's called The Story of Ruth. And I think it was in color, so I don't know when year it was. But yeah, I knew it was in color. I remember that. And they take some deals with it, but they showed that this is not very much different than what was going on. And Ruth was, as it turns out, she lived in Moab, which is over there east of the Jordan, and was a very pagan society that worshipped the god Chemosh. Chemosh was a god to which they practiced child sacrifice and other factors. And of course, they take some liberties. They have Ruth being a priestess in the cult, which there's no evidence of that. But she was a Moabite. And it does show that these cultures, the Jews and the Moabites, and the way they clash in their religious beliefs. And so she becomes a believer, Ruth does. And and then it also kind of shows like the Jews and how hard-headed they were. And, you know, they said, well, when did you practice your last, did you train children to worship Chemosh? Yes. Did you go with them when they were sacrificed to their God? Yes. Did you do all this? Yes. When did you do it? Well, just months ago. And they're all, you know, freaking out. Months ago. So then they got a couple of guys. Of course, these were spies from Moab. They came in to bear false witness against it. But it was all kind of interesting in that you could tell. And she told Naomi, she said, you know, she had come to this deal where she realized that the gods of the pagans, the Chemosh, that particular god, and the God of Israel made more sense to her. And that she'd embraced him, because she makes that great statement, and they even have it in the movie. Wherever you go, I go. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. And then she gets there, and the Jews are all tough on her. They're legalistic, duh. And this woman's a Moabite, and she's got to die because she's a pagan. And, you know, it was like no one could ever convert or come to faith. And, you know, but she had. And as it turns out, well, she gives birth to Obed. She marries into the Jewish line, into the tribe of Judah. She gives birth to Obed, And Abed becomes the father of Jesse, and Jesse becomes the father of who? David. So here's this pagan Moabitess who's now in the line of Messiah. And because she believed. But it showed how the conflict of these cultures and these religious practices and all of that. So I thought it was a pretty good movie as far as movies go. And again, they took a few deals. But they showed in this movie how the Moabites made fun. Oh, you believe in an invisible God. And so there was a little piece of logic in the movie where this guy tells Ruth, well, let's say your soldier's out on the field and he's fighting in a battle. And he's dying. And he can't get back here to pray to Chemosh. And she goes, he said, well, does he pray to Chemosh? And she goes, yeah. He said, well, isn't he invisible to him at that time? And I guess he is now that I mentioned. So she realized the concept of an invisible God wasn't that hard to actually figure out. God's invisible if you're not, their God even was invisible if you weren't there. You couldn't see him. So, again, many of these cultures, and Rome was one like them, they did not accept the idea of a single, omniscient, omnipotent God. Romans viewed themselves as being superior to those they conquered and ruled. That was very common in the pagan world, that the view was, our gods are better than your gods if we can beat you on the battlefield. And if we take you down, then that means our God's superior to your God, and so therefore you're going to pay the price for this. Your God's not strong enough. Too bad. So there you go. All right, well, we'll stop there before I go outside and strangle somebody. We've only got a couple of minutes anyway. They obviously can't read. That's tough. But we will pick up here on Tuesday evening. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for this time together. We pray you would sanctify this information to our souls. In Christ's name, amen.